From the backstretch at Saratoga, this is Loose on the Lead with Steve Bick and Seth Merrill.
Good morning and welcome to Loose on the Lead on this Sunday morning. Steve Bick is in the house and also happy to be joined by Sean Clancy. Sean, good morning.
Good morning.
Sean, Seth, good morning.
Good morning. We headed off the handicapping show earlier, talking a little bit about, obviously, congratulations to Arcangelo. Good story there. Gonna Echo Zulu, Bolshoi Ballet, but unfortunately, the meat is just a little bit snake-bitten, and that was the case again yesterday with New York Thunder. So, I mean, we can head off the conversation with that because it was, again, another tough day with that situation. We move on. The officials were taking a look at the track condition overnight and whatnot. We're racing today. We're off the turf in a couple of races this afternoon. But, again, another rough day given the situation yesterday.
Yeah, I mean, look, it's for all of us in the sport. It's it just hits you at the knees, and you know, it's hard to explain, hard to justify, hard to understand. You know, I was there with Pete, Joe, my brother, and Tom Long. Guys, you know, we're lifers. We've been in this game forever, and it just takes you. It just knocks you down. I mean, it takes you to your and. You know, it's. I mean, if there was an easy answer, we'd obviously have that answer. I think that's one thing you got to remember. I mean, it's an obviously a very difficult problem. The horses have always been a fragile animal. Whether that's worse today than it was years ago, I don't know. I mean, some things I think yes, some things maybe not. I know there's more care, more attention to it today than there's ever been. Sadly, you still have them, and it does. It just rocks your world. It just, you question everything. You question your whole life. You question your career choice. You question your dedication. You question whether you want to keep going in it. And I think that goes for anybody that's in this sport. We all love this sport, but there's days like yesterday are just they just rock you like nothing can. I mean, I've never been just twice up here this meet. I've just never been rocked like that in my life. It's just, it's tough.
We obviously went through this 4 weeks ago in the wake of Maple Leaf Mel, and one of the challenges that I think we've got as an industry is trying to assuage the outside observers, and not just the outside observers, but the people that turned away in horror, and there's no other way to describe it. And we can equate these two incidents that are honestly so strangely paralleled, two undefeated and fleet young horses that I happened to be watching the race in the racing office with Linda Rice, Shug McGahee, Bill Mott, and Butch Reed. And so a pretty good panel of observers and industry veterans. And they were all as mystified and bewildered by this and the parallel between Maple Leaf Mel and New York Thunder. And one thing that Linda said was, I mean, these are horses too fast for their own good. All of those kinds of descriptors are really inadequate in the larger picture. And I hate to be somebody that is going to come out with numbers and with quotes, but there's really no other way to confront this than to explain that we have one-third reduced incidents and catastrophic breakdowns by 35% in a little over a decade. Those numbers continue to go down on a regular basis. Spates of injuries and fatalities are random. They're multifactorial. The reality is that we have had over the last 15 years or so between 10 and 20 fatalities at this meet. We've had 15 so far. This is not a group of fatalities that are out of the norm. They're being felt like they're out of the norm because of the glaring way in which specifically New York Thunder and Maple Leaf Mel were felled. But this is not some giant aberration, twice what we usually have. It just feels like it. And the media scrutiny and the social media cacophony is simply amplifying the scenario and the situation. And all of the people that are going to put their expertise against these, with the necropsies, with the evaluation of the racetrack, with all of the evaluations of the horses, you realize that these incidents are coming under the greatest scrutiny horses have ever had on an American racetrack. These horses are being evaluated more closely than ever. And it lends itself to the reality they're always going to get hurt and they're going to die. And that's part of the confrontation we're going to have with people every time there's a scenario like this. And the panic and the sky is falling response will do no one any good, not the industry going forward or anybody involved. You just have to keep working as hard as possible to minimize these incidents. And the problem is, you've got people that were here yesterday, were here 4 weeks ago, that are going to turn away and not come back. And I don't know I don't know if there's any way to get those people back. But the care and attention to these horses is at the highest level ever. And that's all we can say. That's the only response that we can have.
Look, that was well said. I mean, I agree with that. I do. I think we have to. I wrote it in a column earlier this meet. I mean, we have to concentrate on the tangible things that we can improve, we can change, we can affect. I think if you concentrate on race conditions or how these horses are trained. I mean, we've made dramatic changes. No more anabolic steroids. The joint injections. We've changed a lot of stuff in the sport, which has been commendable. But you have to concentrate on the things you can affect. And the facilities where we train. You know, in American thoroughbred racing, training on a track where you're running is very difficult. I hear people say, why can't the main track be as good as the Oklahoma track? Well, the Oklahoma track, it closes at 10:30 in the morning, and they have till 5:30 the next morning to do whatever they want to it. They can seal it. They can add to it. I'm not a track guy. I don't understand. I mean, I don't have the expertise. But, you know, the pressure that these guys are under at this meet 5 days a week with the amount of races we're running, it's hard to maintain the track. And Glenn Kozak always says, the track superintendent, it's not the amount of rain, it's when it rains. And we've had days up here when we've just had these torrential downpours in the middle of the day during when the track is open. The turf course, we've had races on the turf while a complete monsoon. So, I mean, those things are really tricky when it comes to trying to balance the safety of our horses. The industry needs to get together and concentrate on the tangible things that we can do, and that's improving our training facilities.
Diagnostics,
deciding on, you know, you talk to these trainers, I mean, the horses, they aren't as sound as they were at one time. Yes, I mean, the statistics are there, but the trainers say they're not as tough as they once were. And, I mean, why is that? Is that the Is that the way they're being raised? I mean, I go all the way back to, like, the GMO type foods, the soy based products that these horses are probably getting fed now as young horses. You know, has their diet changed? I mean, the humans' diets have changed to such a degree. You know, can go all the way back to that. I mean, I think there's all those. I mean, there's so many factors. Again, if it was an easy thing to fix, we would fix it, obviously, because the people in the sport. I mean, as we talked about, I mean, that we're rocked. The people on the fringe they're more than rocked. They're turned away and they're finished. So I do think we have to concentrate on tangible things that we can change. I think we've done that very well. I mean, everybody knew that anabolic steroids we need to rid our game of anabolic steroids. We've done that. You know, we have concentrated on things and been able to do. I still think there has to be an equine hospital at every racetrack. I mean, I understand the 1863 club. That's brilliant. I'm sure it makes a lot of money for an IRA. But, you know, should you invest that kind of money in an equine hospital therapy center for horses where they have access to a vibrating plate? They have access to a saltwater therapy. They have access to a hyperbaric chamber. Who's going to pay for it and how it's going to work? Now, that's obviously the devil's in the detail. But we don't have a proper equine hospital rehab therapy center at the racetrack. You need to concentrate on those kind of things. The facilities, I mean, I'm watching horses train this morning. Horses are jogging the wrong way of a racetrack on their quiet day. They go out and jog 2 miles on a racetrack where they just galloped or where they just breezed. You've got to separate the horses where they have quiet days. You got to get the horses off the... You know, literally our horses they breeze and they gallop on a racetrack, and on their quiet day, they go out on the same exact racetrack where they just breezed or just galloped, and their friends are galloping the wrong way. Their friends are going this way and they're going this way on a quiet day. That it's just, you see our horses, they're stressed. We have a stressful environment. I mean, so I think those are the things. Could you create a jogging track? Could you create... I mean, I look back at the Horse Haven track. They paved over Horse Haven. They paved it over before... I mean, I think I galloped on it 1 year up here, maybe 87 or 86 or something. But that was a wonderful track. You could take horses and have a kind of quiet time over there. We've got to think about those kind of things. We've got to think about the tangible things that you can affect and concentrate on those while looking at everything, while obviously studying and all the other factors. But... to me, that's so important. We've got to think about the facilities and the training facilities where we have our horses. And I don't mean just the quality of the dirt. It's you know, giving them other options to be able to train in quiet environments. I go back even like on. I mean, are these big days? Are they the best thing for our horses? I mean, the energy of yesterday. I mean, the horses feel when you get on a horse. Sure. A horse feels if you're in a bad mood. They know if you're in a hurry. I mean, I can literally go get on a horse in our farm, and if I'm running out of time. I don't ride that horse as well. Horse is like, man, what's going on? If I'm in a good mood, a horse goes better. He's just having a better day. You think about the energy in that place yesterday, and the electricity, and all the races. They start at 11:30 post and go until 7 o'clock. And I understand it. You're generating handle. I understand that. But is that the best thing for our horses, Dad? The stress that they're put under? The hardest part of our game, there's not two things. None of the things are aligned. The best thing for the horse is not the best thing for the better. The optional claimer was invented for the better, to get a full field. So you get 12 horses in a race. You take the optional claimer away, if it was a straight non-winners of three, you'd get 6, 7, 8 horses. But you're putting horses that have never won 3 races together. They're actually grouped together. Those are the races they should be in. You add in the claiming part, 62, 5, 40, whatever it is. Now you've got 12, and you've got horses in there that have won 10 races. Have made 800,000 8-year-old warriors, and they're running against a 4-year-old that's run 7 times trying to build his career. Why do we do that? For the better, to generate handle. I understand that, but nothing is going. No two things align in our sport. Everything for the racetrack management, not everything, but the racetrack management's what their profit. It's not always the best thing for the horse. It's not always full fields, big days aren't the best thing for the horse. Yeah, that's the hardest part.
That's a high level scenario. I mean, one of the things that you talk about conditions, at the turf sprints, which are popular with horsemen,
full fields,
with owners, with bettors. Yeah. But at the same time, they're the first races that management is inclined to take off the turf because it tears the turf up.
Yes.
The five and a half. You know, one thing, Sean, with your, I'll fold in another thing, and when it comes to, you mentioned hospital facilities and clinic facilities, one thing that would go a long way at literally every racetrack, or somehow centrally available or mobily available, is the scanning equipment to find the hot spots and find fissures. Yeah. These microfractures, these are the starts of breakdowns. Yeah. You know, even in a horse that's presenting sound, that won't palpate, and you know, a vet can go over them. Doesn't matter if it's a racetrack practitioner or a regulatory vet. They'll go through a horse jogs fine. There's little tiny microfractures in key parts of bone that under stress and under certain conditions of the surface that basically come apart, and that's how we're getting these kind. And this has been brought out in every investigation. Everything in this arena goes back to the 2010 aqueduct fatality study involving Dr. Palmer and Alan Foreman and Mary Scalay and Jerry Bailey, everybody on that committee, and they put together a brilliant study that is a template now for how to essentially approach spates of injuries. And almost every major track has had sets of these kinds of injuries. And the one thing that could go the longest way is basically seeing these kinds of physical problems before they present themselves to veterinarians. I want to ask you, though, as an evaluator of talent and the physical properties of a horse, about what has happened in regards to saleability. And the fact that some of the bloodlines, this came up in that group yesterday in the racing office, that basically starting in the 80s and with Stormcat, that pretty yearlings and you know, horses that presented as elegant became more the focus of the sales arena. And the big, raw-boned, heavy horses, the King Mambo lines, those type of horses, the big, rangy types, there's any number of stallions that, you know, as they fell away in that era, people didn't, they became unfashionable as sales prospects. With that, though, comes the loss of bone density, and you know, McPeak talks about this, too, a lot. The sturdiness, I mean, I know I'm not somebody that believes that, you know, that the breed has become brittle, but there are some things that have affected the direction of breeding, and that came up yesterday, and I'm curious your thoughts, because you know some of those stallions that you know basically went away and weren't replaced, that got big kind of raw-boned type horses that weren't fashionable in the ring, and how much of that contributes to, if there is in fact a more vulnerable thoroughbred in this era, how much of that do you think contributes?
I think it contributes for sure. I mean, I think the trend from being owners and breeders that you bred your horses to race and you raised them tough and you raised them just they were in a big group and they just knocked the heck out of each other and learned how to do it, and nobody was X-raying yearlings and foals and having them in stalls, and they certainly weren't being on going around in circles on equisizers and getting pumped up for the sale, because the sale didn't matter. You just wanted to bring your product to your trainer. That trend has changed a lot. I mean, if you look at what England did to, England changed their breed with Sadler's Wells, with Dane Hill, with American bred horses, Northern Dancer line. I mean, if you look at the great stallions in Europe, you go back 2-3 generations, it's all North American blood. I mean, that, not all, but the influence of North American blood that went over there with the likes of, I mean, Sadler's Wells, Dane Hill, you look at all those horses. You know, we changed our breed with Stormcat, and you know, everybody knows it's not throwing a sound horse. And they, you know, yeah, they were brilliantly fast, but for the most part, and they weren't the soundest horses. I think there's a lot of lines like that that are, you know, questionable how sound they are. But if you're breeding for the sales ring and you're breeding for the 2-year-old sales, then that has completely changed. I don't feel like I'm that old, but I look back at, you know, my upbringing watching Paul Mellon's horses get off the van in front of Burley Cox's barn in Camden, South Carolina. Ralph G. Smith van would show up and be 12 horses would walk off, and they were now the jumpers of Paul Mellon's. These 3-, 4-, 5-year-old geldings, I mean, they were like by Bold Ruler and Round Table and Arts and Letters, and I mean, they were just big, beautiful. Yeah, I mean, these horses, I was 16, 15, 16, 17, I'd stand there and just watch these horses walk off the van. And they were just one after another after another. I mean, I know their name. I mean, Senator Brady and Lights of Music. And, I mean, they were just, these horses were just beautiful. And you barely ever see horses like that anymore. And so that has changed. The way we raise them, the way we breed them, the way we train them. You know, all that has changed dramatically. Again, that's not the silver bullet. If ever it isn't going to be just okay here, yep, Everybody goes back to breeding their own. But that is one factor. I mean, the trainers with huge barns is one factor. The training facilities is one factor. The breeding is one factor. I think Big Days is. I mean, that's not having Big Days isn't going to fix the problem. That's just one of the elements. One of the questions. And I don't know. I mean, you have to look back. I mean, I remember being at Delaware Park growing up as a kid in the 70s. And if you saw a horse break 114 for 3/4 of a mile, you went, wow, look at this. He went 13-2. Wow, look at this, you know. And now you see just every race, they're going so fast. And, again, that's a fact, you know, one of the elements. I don't know. I mean, look. As I said, I wish if there was an easy answer, we'd certainly have it, and we would have made it long ago. As I wrote earlier in the meet, look, we can concentrate on making the game safer, but it's never going to be safe.
Yeah,
it's
not, that was well put.
And that's just the bottom line of what we do. I think from people in the game, I think it's really important that everybody else out there knows how much that rocked us yesterday. And it's a very, very, it's a real battle with yourself to say, I love horses and I love horse racing and I love it. And then to stand there and watch what happened yesterday. And we say, we're in it because we love the horses. And then you see a horse just die in front of you. And that is an existential question. And you ask yourself, that is a very, very confounding part of mankind. I wrestled with that. I stood there yesterday going, like, what? I wanted to go home. Then I can't go home. You don't know what to do.
We should also, we're obviously concentrating on the most obvious incident and tragedy. We're remiss not mentioning Nobel for Brendan Walsh. Who was galloping out in the fifth race in the turf that turf marathon, and fractured an ankle and had to be euthanized. So there was that
and
as well.
It should be noted that after that happened, the racing officials were out there for a half an hour looking at the ground where it had. I mean, it's not, none of this is taken lightly by the industry. And that all plays into all the subjects we brought up this morning. They will all be looked into, and they will all be considered, hopefully, and certainly overnight, a lot of this was discussed by the parties that are in play here. And as you said, Steve, earlier, over the past 10 years or so, the industry has addressed it aggressively, because everybody, it doesn't help anybody to have happen what happened yesterday. So we want it to become, this sport to become as safe as it possibly can become. But again, we have to convey to people it is an athletic event, and these kind of things will happen. We just have to strive as hard as we can to make it the lowest number we can possibly make.
Look, the bottom line of horse racing is we have athletes who cannot tell us, my knee's bothering me. You know, I mean, my son's 14 years old. He's a left-handed pitcher, and his coaches every game, every practice, how's your arm feel? Your arm feel okay? I mean, they've got a pitch count, and I mean, one kid's elbow, he's like, my elbow's bothering me. We stopped him for the, you know, we have an athlete who cannot tell us I mean, you can watch them and you can try. I mean,
there's indications.
Yes, I mean, Bill Mott's the greatest line any trainer's ever said to me was when Bill Mott had favorite trick. Aiming for the Kentucky Derby, and I was 27 years old and just daft enough to ask him, hey, do you really think you can get a mile and a quarter? And Bill Mott stared at me and stared at me, and to the point where I was about to ask it again because I think he's like, you know, didn't hear me. And he says, horses, give us the information and we are expected to use it. That is the greatest. I try to keep that in mind every time I do anything with a horse. I mean, we've got old retirees. You know, I had this old lovely horse, Dictina's boy, lived out in the field. One day he was lying down. I thought, wow, look, he never lies down. That's why. And then I kind of got thinking. And my wife's a better horse than I am, and she's like, that's weird. What's he doing lying down? We go out there, and man, he was basically colicking right there, and we put him down. But like. They give you the information, but they don't give you the information. They can't tell it to you. Now you have to be, all of us in the sport need to, you know. I think horses have given us the information here this meet. I mean, there's some things that you can look at and say, okay. I mean, I think the turf breakdowns. I think you have to look and say, wait a minute, something. You know, I think we've probably run. I mean, I think we've run too many races on soft turf here early in the meet, and I think the turf is. I think that is one thing, again, a tangible thing. You say, you know, we run more turf races up here than we've ever run. I mean, sure. You think back of 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago. I mean, they used to not run turf sprints because they said they didn't want to tear up the turf. Because a short meet, you didn't want to tear up the turf. And now we run turf sprints. I mean, the day after they canceled four races because of rain, we ran a turf sprint. And the clods were coming back like this. I'm sorry, any of us would say, that's questionable how you can get that back repaired.
Explain that, Sean, because one of the things that people, not just variables, but there's so many things about these scenarios that are at sort of cross purpose, including things like, they should make the track slower and heavier, it'll be safer. No.
Correct.
As it happens, if a horse has a compromised scenario internally, if they get more tired slogging through a heavy racetrack, they're more susceptible to having that incident occur. So actually, a faster, tighter track is better for a horse that may be in a vulnerable position. Then there's the turf is probably too soft for them to get... No, it's not them getting over the soft turf that day.
Correct.
It's the cut into the ground that when it dries leaves a trap for one to get their hoof in there and snap it. It's not the soft turf when it's soft, it's the hole that is left. Correct. Explain why that's the peril.
No, that's exactly right. I mean, I would worry less about my horse running on the turf while it's raining, and I worry more about him running the next day after it's stopped raining and you've torn up the turf. I mean, that's just the most important thing for a horse is consistency. It wouldn't matter. Like, you could, if you gallop him down the hard road and it's consistent, but like that's going. I mean, that's a bad analogy, but. The inconsistency, we do it in steeplechasing. We try to irrigate some of our tracks, and a lot of times when we irrigate a track, it's worse than if you just left it alone because you can't manage the irrigation. You know, you could with more money and a better system, but if you an inadequate irrigation system is worse than no irrigation system. We've just learned that over the years. You're better off with firm turf. The horse understands it; he gets it. So, and I think that's when they've studied these tracks when they've had problems. They like even back at Laurel, there were spots in the track that were inconsistent. So back to our point with the turf, an inconsistent turf course is what that's the worst thing you can have. Not just a straight soft course, that's consistent. A firm turf course with good ground cover that hasn't been torn up, that's consistent, and that to me is safer. I know from my riding days, it's just when you were on an inconsistent surface, that's where you get in trouble. Like, you know, heavy spots of a track, and I think that's been proven over the years, the inconsistency
main track
of the track.
Too. This is not limited. This discussion is not limited to turf.
Correct. And, yeah. That, and, no. Exactly. Yeah.
And one of the things when they talk about, you know, worrying about the main track. John Nehrud, in his conversations with me on the radio, talked, everything I know about this came from Nehrud, about, and this was in the wake of the aqueduct study, when you get fissures in the base, it's not the cushion, it's the base underneath, and all of a sudden there's like a little fissure in the track, and suddenly on the cushion, literally feet above, there's a soft spot in what looks like a smooth, beautiful dirt course. And in fact, when the horse hits that spot, they sink down just that much further, and that's all it takes. Again, if there's a vulnerability within them, it's going to get exploited. So that's why this is such a whack-a-mole situation. And everybody's like, oh, you talk about Maple Leaf Mel and New York Thunder. Well, it happened on the same part. No, it didn't. It didn't happen on the same part of the track. It happened a 16th of a mile apart.
Correct.
You know, we've had five horses, fatalities on the turf. Well, actually, one was a cardiac incident, and four on all different places. I mean, this is what is so vexing. At Churchill, years ago, it's not as much of an issue now, Churchill had, in their first turn, they always had a problem because of a drainage portion. At Santa Anita, the overhang of the building, Johnny DeSantis taught me this, the overhang of that building on the corner, there was a shadow, so that when there'd be rain, that one section of the turn dried at a different rate than the rest of the racetrack. Yeah. That's why this is so difficult to try to get people to just understand and appreciate all of these working parts. There's nothing in any other world of sport that is this complex. And I guess if that makes us, you know, anachronistic, that's one of the problems that we've got, and that we're going to have to face. And again, there's so many parts of this that are just that don't seem logical. One of the ones that makes me nuts. Well, we shouldn't race them until if you don't stress them as a young horse, they're going to be even more vulnerable later. You have to train them as yearlings and 2-year-olds. That's what toughens their bones and gets them fit and makes them less vulnerable. The longer you wait to get a horse going, the more susceptible they're going to be to injury and catastrophic issues. And so trying to explain this every time is a challenge, but it's one that if you love the game and you're a stakeholder from horse player to breeder to owner, to whatever aspect you're involved, it's incumbent on us to take the time, not get exasperated, and not say, well, if they don't understand, we don't need that. No. You've got to explain to people that everybody is committed here, and will double down on the commitment to make things as safe as possible. We got about maybe 20, 25 minutes. Scott Blasi is going to join us after a mammoth day for the Asmussen Barn. I want to lighten the mood by talking about your first Grade 1 win as River D Stables. It came on Thursday in the Jonathan Shepherd New York Turf Riders Cup Handicap, and it was so spectacular. And even now, 3 days later, there are still some people Sean has not hugged.
You're out there. I'm coming looking for you.
You'll see him later.
I might kiss you too.
Get your hug, because he's still got more in him. Congratulations.
Thank you. That was as special a day as I've ever had in racing. I mean, to come
better than when you won.
Yeah, it's just so different. It's so different. I mean, it's 25 years. So I mean, I won the race. I won it once. I mean, I rode jump races for 13 years in Saratoga. I won 5 races total in 13 years. So I won the Turf Riders once, and then came back. And I've been owning horses now. I mean, River D Stables had horses up here for, we've been running off and on for 10, probably 10 years, and that's my second win ever at Saratoga. So, I mean, that's and I mean, we have a successful racing stable. I mean, we do well, and that's that I think that explains or shows how difficult it is. I mean, I retired. I was 10th leading jockey in the history of sport races won ever. And I won 5 races total at Saratoga in 13 years. So that is how difficult it is to be successful here. Believe me. I came up here in 1988. I didn't win a race until 1994. I had never won a race up here. When I won my first race, I finally said to, like, Denny McCabe, my valet, I said, "That's the first race I've ever won here." And he was like, "Whoa!" And I did it yesterday. I mean, I did it Wednesday when actually to you, I said, "That's my first grade one." And I'd never won a grade one. It's not something you go out and tell everybody. Like, I'd ridden grade one winners. I sold a bunch of grade one winners. But I'd never owned a grade one winner. And so that moment to accomplish that was, that's just, you know, it's your life's work. It's
talk about picking up the horse. And how'd you get, you're in there with Ted Strake, which is Marshall Graham. How'd you get Marshall?
So it's interesting. Pete Fornatale actually had a fundraiser for the TRF, I think, and had a small group together early in the meet in 2021. And he invited me, and I sat next to Marshall Graham, and we chatted. And I knew about Ted Strake, but I'd never met him. And he said at the end of the gig, he said if you ever have a jumper you want to partner with, I'd like to do that. He said I like that. I don't know anything about it, but I'd like to support it. I think it's a good part of thoroughbred racing, and if you ever see a horse, I'll get involved. And that summer, I've been watching Awaken for months. I text Chug McGee every time he runs. I'm like, "Hey, I'm Awaken." "Not yet, not yet, not yet." And then he won going 1.25 miles at Ellis Park up here. And we watched it in our box. We watched it at the TV, Tom Law, Joey, and I. And I pointed at the TV. I was like, "That's a jumper. That's a jumper." And then about a week later, Shug called me and said, "What about Awaken?" And I thought, well, my first thought was, "Man, why is he calling me now after he won?" And he said, "Look, he didn't come out of the race that great. He's got bone bruising. He's totally fine. We've x-rayed everything. He's fine, but he needs the time." And I said, who looked at him? He said, "Dr. Chaney, who I know very well, vets a lot of horses for me." I said, can I call Chaney?" He said, "Yeah, call him. Look at that. Do anything you want." So I called Dr. Chaney. He said, "Sean, this horse will be fine. You got to give him 60 days. I said, "Dr. Chaney, I'm going to give him 120 days. I'm not going to look at this horse until January 15th. He said, "Perfect." He said, "Where is he going?" I said, "Jack Fisher." He said, "When he gets to Jack Fisher's barn, don't even walk him in the stall to take the bandages off. Turn him out. Turn him out and leave him out." So we turned him out in a big field of Jack Fisher's, probably 5, 8, 10 horses out there, a couple old timers and a couple, and he lived out from basically August 15th until January 15th. Got a shed and trees, but the horses never go into sheds. They stand under the trees or stand out in the middle of the field in a rainstorm. And he lived out. He did not come in. He did not have a roof over his head other than a shed from August 15th to January 15th of August 15th of 2021, roughly, to January 15th of 2022. Jack brings all his horses and he starts them up January 15th. It wouldn't matter if it's on a Sunday or on his birthday or on Mother's Day. They start training January 15th. He came in January 15th, and no one has ever said a word about Awaken. "How's Awaken?" "Good, yep, fine." "Good, yep, fine." He's the most unassuming, laid-back, lovely character. And, you know, he's by curling out of daydreaming. So you get the Phippses that you go back to look at his pedigree. It's just, I mean, number to count. And, I mean, his horse is just all the way back to Letroyenne. I mean, he goes back to her.
The new snap decision.
Yeah, exactly. And that's, yeah, I mean, that's, again, that's where we want our horses from those type of outfits because they take care of horses. I don't buy horses from Phippses and Shug to think I'm going to improve them. I buy them because they've taken great care of the horses. I try to buy horses from Bill Mott. I try to buy horses from Charlie Lopresti. You try to buy horses from old school horsemen who take great care of the horses. And that's why he's able to do what he did.
What were your expectations on Wednesday? I used him on top, so I was thrilled too. And unfortunately, I said to you, I was back here still working. because I would have loved to have been over there on the front side. But I saw you later in the day. You still had the smile brewing.
Did
later
you get your hug?
Well, we got the picture.
Oh, there it is. It's a great moment.
And we got you had the nice picture. You were snapping some photos. But what was your thoughts? Because I thought I thought the Kaiser was a good effort. Yeah. And I thought he was set up on Wednesday. What were your expectations?
No, I liked him a lot. I mean, I was tempering him just because we live in this game that you have to temper your, you know. I did a stable tour with George Weaver. He said, we're trying to get to the Breeders' Cup with past the Chamonix. He goes, I say trying because I'm a horse trainer.
Yeah.
I think we'll get there, but I say trying because I'm a horse trainer. So, like all of us, I was tempering my... I wasn't not confidence, but I did. I loved his race in the Kaiser. I loved him coming back, going 2 3/8 because he just wants distance. The Kaiser, I like seeing horses when they don't have to finish where they do. Like he could have been, he easily could have been second, beaten 10 lengths, but he just kept grinding away at him. He got beat 3 3.5 lengths. I mean, it was convincing, but I liked the way he ran all the way to the line. Knowing, I mean, horses are smart. He like knows he's not catching the other horse. I mean, he just keeps going. So I like that. I like Jack Fisher's horses coming back in 3 weeks. He's able to kind of keep a horse pretty steady. He never gets them real. He doesn't really train horses to peak efforts. He kind of gets them fit, leaves them alone. So I like that. I love the field. I mean, that was a grade one, but it was not. There wasn't. I mean, if Snap Decision was in there, I wouldn't have run. If the Mean Queen was in there, I wouldn't have run. If Belfast Panther, winner of the AP Smith, was in there, I wouldn't have run. I ran in it. We ran in it because it was basically a novice race. I mean, it was, you know, the first three home were novices. I love Jimmy P. I made one bet. I walked up and I bet a $10 exacta box awakened Jimmy P. And that was all I did. Those were my two strong opinions. I didn't think if he was 10-1, I would have gone in hard, but he's 5-6-1. I didn't think that was enough value, and I had enough obviously riding on it. But no, I thought he'd run well. I love the horse. I mean, this game is like you guys know. It's a matter of your convictions, and you have to follow your convictions.
Was that Marshall's first grade one?
I don't know. I didn't ask.
Wondering about that. That may have been his first grade.
Could have been.
So now you kind of the way you're talking. I'm interested now. What have you planned out? Anything?
Not really. I mean, there's the Aqueduct race is coming back in 3 weeks. That's a little short. I would rather there's a Lonesome Glory in the Entenmann. The Entenmann's a novice race. I think Snap Decision's going for the Lonesome Glory, so I wouldn't take on Snap Decision there. I could go to the Entenmann. He's still a novice. He has a novice condition for the fall, so he's still got some conditions.
Explain that to people.
So it's basically a date. You know, you can't have broken your maiden. Now it switches to the fall, but you can't have broken your maiden over hurdles before September 1st for the fall of the year before. And he won in September, so he still has a novice condition. So usually I wouldn't run him back in 3 weeks. I would wait and run him at Far Hills, aim there, and just run him once more. He doesn't like soft ground. We ran him once on soft ground at Far Hills. It's the only poor race he's ever run. So I that's where it leaned me a little bit to going back to Aqueduct, flat track, firm turf, and then maybe call it a year after that. But, look, we're going to celebrate and think about Wednesday.
I don't know if we've got more of the race other than the stretch run, but part of Sean's description of this and Tom Garner's ride, we got to talk about Garner because you know it's 4 minutes and for about 3 minutes and 38 seconds, Sean is muttering at poor Tom Garner, and then suddenly, oh, he's our Caro.
He was skipping the cones, though, for sure. Man, he was saving every inch of ground.
No, and it's a credit to Tom and the horse, too. I mean, we talked in the paddock, we wanted to be third on the inside. He's kind of a high cruising speed, doesn't have a big turn of foot. We wanted to be third inside like he was in the Kaiser. He breaks and jumps the first fence. He's got one horse behind him. I mean, I threw my hands up and pushed back in the chair. I was like, he's too far back. He's too far back. And then in that 10-horse field, you couldn't fix it. I mean, once you're in there, my dad's 88 years old. I mean, you know, I've
been a trainer.
He rode races. And I talked to him after the race, and he said, Bud, I know he was too far back for your liking. And I know he was too far back for his liking, but that kid, he never panicked. He never, if he tried to pull out or he tried to do something, he just sat in there and grinned and bared. And that's why he won. And he's exactly right. I mean, you can't, You know, the bet is made. You got to sit in there and you got to stay there.
I had Greinke. Yeah. I think it was Greinke that said it. But so he's winding up his riding career. This is a great way to go. Yeah. And he's headed over to that crazy race over.
He wants to ride the Partibici in Czechoslovakia.
And where it's like a figure eight and they go.
Yeah,
they jump
these fences about this tall. So we were back in the office and my nephew Nolan, who was on the show, he's lovely. And we're watching we turned on some replays of the Partibici. So they run down, they jump the Taxus as this jumps like over this, it's higher than this tent. I mean, it's a crazy race. And we're watching it, and Nolan says, he shouldn't be doing this. And I said, hey, he's a jump jockey, he's got to do it. You know, he's just, but yeah, he said he wants to retire at the end of the year. I went out on the course, and I said, man, that's my first grade one, buddy. And I put my hand out, and he said that's probably my last grade one. And he said, I'm finishing at the end of the year. It's my last one here.
That's right. Yeah.
The last one here. And he's a lovely guy. I was very proud of him. He's had a rough go kind of business-wise this year. I was excited to have him on the horse. He gave him a beautiful ride, never panicked. And it's a credit to the horse, too, when you think about him. I mean, again, what you like about horses.
Sorry. I never do that.
The horse has unbelievable balance. You know, it's why I liked him in the first place. And that's for him to, the reason he could stay in there, not get bumped around, make those spots, get through the spots, is because his athletic ability, his balance, his, you know, all those. I mean, it's really pedigree. You go back, I'm sorry, you learn all that. I mean, curling out of daydreaming, and that helps when you need to get here, there, wherever. It's just how it goes. So.
Before we let you go, let's get a thought on yesterday's win by Arcangelo. I like Mage. Mage didn't show up, and I thought Arcangelo. I was concerned
Gustavo
about the layout.
Gustavo Delgado has a different view of the race.
And I probably do too, actually. But Arcangelo, the layup, the 77 days. Birdstone did it in 84 days, and so it's been done, but that concerned me. But layup, no problem. Arcangelo now steps to the front of the three-year-old class. What were your thoughts yesterday?
My first and main thought is that I love when a small trainer wins a big race and proves yet again that anybody can win big races, and I think that was it's a great credit to a hardworking small trainer that's taken a very individualized approach to get her horse to a big race, and that to me is the most important part, is to for everybody to look and realize, look, there's a lot. I mean, the amount of great horsemen that are out there that don't get a chance, and this. Jenna Antonucci's got a chance with a good horse, and she just proved it. I mean, she stuck to her guns. She had conviction. She's never been in this position in her life, and she did what she thought was best for her horse, and won the biggest race of the summer, biggest race of her career. And it's comforting, and I think it's important for everybody to realize that. There's a lot of good horsemen out there that need a chance.
Found it notable in the post-race press conference, too, Castellano, who record seventh ever.
Amazing.
But he noted, and I hadn't even thought about it, he said last year he wasn't even here because he couldn't get a mount on Traverse Day, so he was down in Monmouth. And 2 years ago, he had one mount on Traverse Day in a maiden special, but he has come back in fine fashion in 2023.
Yeah, and I think he needs to take a little responsibility for, and I think he probably does. I don't think he was as healthy. I mean, he tells you when he finally got his hip operated on, and it took him a while to get his business back. And I think, you know,
PJ Campo deserves
done an amazing job.
Credit.
But Javier, I mean, he's riding now as good as he ever rode, and he went through a spell where he probably wasn't riding. People see how you're riding, and I think it's a credit to him to be able to come back, get the surgery, come back, build his business back. PJ Campo's done an amazing job. He's a great rider. He made some moves yesterday. I mean, that was a beautiful ride to sit there and wait. He got a position. He got a beautiful position around the first turn. I thought, man, that's perfect. And then he looks. He's got three in front of him. He knows, figured, I got those three. He can tell. Three behind him. Okay, all I got to do is I got to get first run on those guys, but I'm not going to overdo it. He slides out. Good jockey's brilliant. He knows I got I don't have to go after these guys at the 3/8 pole. If I can't beat them, if I got to try to beat them at the 3/8 pole, I'm never going to beat them. So he just sits there, waits, tips out, makes one run. I would say jockeys try to win the race once. just try to win the race one time. And he tried to win. He produced the horse. It's quarter pole. Okay, buddy, now let's go win the race. And he did. It's a brilliant run.
We'll watch the race, I'm sure, again when Scott Blasey sits in. So, and we'll watch Disarm, because Joel actually had a very patient ride. And Disarm is going to be very dangerous going forward. These, in fact, to me, these two have sort of elevated themselves on the pecking order. Do we have the graphic for Javier Castellano that I sent in?
They're saying yes, so let's see. There it is.
Here you go. I'll do some politicking right now. 2/3 of the way through the year. We're going to get to December, and Irad Ortiz is going to have more wins, probably going to have more stake wins, going to have way more earnings. Javier Castellano is your Eclipse Award-winning jock, period. Right now, it's not even worth a discussion.
Did you see Tom Garner's ride?
You're right. I'm
that was pretty
Garner
good.
This has been just it's unbelievable what Javier has done and what PJ has done. Derby, Belmont, Travers, the Bev D, United Nations, Secretariat. We'll talk about the Gigante with Blasey as well. On and on and on. The ride in Web Slinger on Derby weekend was unbelievable. He has been spectacular, and it deserves, because he's not, you know, it's not going to be a numbers, an overwhelming case made with numbers. But in terms of quality and in terms of the storyline, you know, people also forget COVID. He was the first jock to get KO'd with COVID, and he was sick. Yeah. And I mean sapped. So between the physical part, sure, with you talked about the surgery, and you know, sort of the fishtailing, you know, after things kind of fell apart with Matt Musiker and you know, so on and so forth. But PJ, in a lot of ways, it's been a rebirth for PJ, in fact, sure, and his career overall. So to me, the Castellano story was tremendous. And as we wrap up, I wanted to be uplifting. This morning I put that TDN video piece up about Gilda Libero, which is lovely if you haven't seen it. I'm pulling your word, lovely. That's your favorite word. But Gilda with Channel Maker, the Jenna story, frankly, the female presence on the racetrack has been as upbeat and uplifting as anything. Jenna's story, and one of the quiet little stories that sort of went under the radar, Katie Bug Davis is having an unbelievable meet. She rode in her first grade one. Lee Einsiedler kept her on the horse because she picked High Oak's head up. And watch the replay. High Oak is getting to the leaders in there, Gunite and Elite Power. High Oak, whose career was, on the rocks after falling in the Fountain of Youth 2 years ago, is suddenly resurrected. You're going to end up seeing him in the Breeders' Cup Sprint, and Lee's going to have both High Oak and Casa Creed. But Katie Davis's story here this summer is one of the best stories. So if you're looking for ways to feel good, they're out there. And we all felt good about Sean Clancy winning that elusive grade one.
Look, my final comment, I this is how I justify being in the sport and justify owning horses and justify making decisions for horses to run over jumps. I know jump racing, the race is more dangerous than the flat race. It's obvious. But I justify it in the way I explain it is every horse, these are thoroughbred racehorses. They were born to race. And Awakens Life is better for me being in it. Whatever decision I make, and I make those decisions for my wife and I. Have horses retired, they're turned out, and some days they're out there getting rained on, and you're wondering if they need a blank. You know, what do they need? I look at those horses, and I look at any horse in my care. Those horses are better off with me in their life and me making the decisions. And I think all of us in the sport when it comes to horses, if you can say to yourself and with complete conviction and you that the horse is better off that you're in their life, and that's, I think the horses are better off that you guys are in the sport and you guys are promoting the sport and talking about the sport and talking about the issues. And I think that's how everybody, if you, it's all you have to ask yourself, is the horse better off for me being involved in this sport? Because the sport is brutal and it can take you to your knees. But if you can honestly say with complete conviction that the horse is better off that I'm involved, and that's what I yes. ask myself, and I think about it, and yes. I keep that as my standard.
It's well said, and I think that's something we have to convey. I know I have relative sisters who are involved in the sport, and not involved in the sport, but on big days like this where they say, you know, what happened, what not, I try to convey, hey, get there on the backstretch, and you'll see what I see. These people love these horses and want the very best for them. Before we let you go, I'll just let you also tout what's the schedule for the special coming up.
Wednesday and Saturday. That's it. Two more issues, and then we're back to reality, I guess, after that.
But, or something yeah, like
yeah. Another great year.
Yeah. Thanks.
All right, we'll take a break. Scott Blasi, we'll do a few minutes and talk about some of the nice Asmussen runners that won yesterday and impressively won yesterday as well. All of that right after this. Stay tuned.
Come on.
I want sales reports on my desk by Monday.
Whoops. My bad.
Love racing? RTN brings you every live simulcast on your home television, plus live video streaming and race replays on your PC and mobile devices. To order, visit RTN.tv. RTN, a breed apart.
Birdstone is an outside front. They're coming down to the finish. Can Smarty Jones hold on? Here comes Birdstone. Birdstone surges past. Birdstone wins the Belmont Stakes.
We're back on Loose on the Lead on this Sunday morning. And for those that I did get a couple of texts, for those that were worried, they're running today. Not an issue. They were running yesterday, and when it came to the Asmussen barn, they were really running. Not a bad Saturday when it comes to Gunite winning the Forego, turning the tables on Elite Power. And then one of the really remarkable stories of the whole year, 2023, is the campaign Echo Zulu is putting together another 112 buyer winning the Ballerina. And then there was the matter of Disarm and coming scooting up the rail and making progress late against Archangelo as Disarm continues his three-year-old campaign and adds a placement in the Traverse. Scott, congratulations.
Thank you very much. It was an awesome day. A length away from being a career day.
Well, there's been plenty of those. We got to start with Echo Zulu because I happen to write in the analysis that considering everything she's done up till now, she doesn't seem to be getting the recognition of being a superstar. She's one of the best filly sprinters probably in the last 10 years. I mean, this is now becoming a habit, and I don't know what else to say.
Yeah, she's just been so special since day one. You know, she's capable of going speeds that other horses aren't capable of doing. And like Florent and I were talking this morning, she's she has that ability just to quicken when you squeeze on her. And she's so funny when you're watching her run. Even when Goodnight Ollie was next to her, her ears were going back and forth. She's running relaxed. And like Florent said, she's literally sitting there waiting for you to ask her to run. And she's doing it at that speed. So, you know, like Steve and I talked, she's got a switch that she can flip that just a lot of horses aren't capable of doing.
She's also now starting to pull off a Jackie's Warrior resume at Saratoga, right?
Yeah, really. Yeah.
Right? She's grade up. One at 2, 3, and 4.
Yeah, she loves this place. She broke her maiden here, and she's been very effective here.
And she's now 4 for 4. The other thing about her that's interesting, and I bring this up often with sprint horses and with trainers of good sprint horses, she's interchangeable between 3/4 and 7/8, and not every filly or mare is so instantly, not just filly and mare, horses of any ilk are not automatically able to go to 7 or, you know, cut back to 6.
Yeah, well, the great, you know, she won the Fairgrounds Oaks down in New Orleans. She was effective at, you know, obviously won the Breeders' Cup Juvenile Fillies. So, you know, she just doesn't want to quite get that mile and an eighth. You know, the Oaks was too much for her, and was pressed every step of the way that day. But, you know, this is what she wants to do, and I think this is what she's special at, and she's definitely in great form.
Got to note that at this point in her career, she's 9 for 11 with the second in the Breeders' Cup Filly and Mare Sprint last year, off of about a 65-70 day layoff, coming out of the Dogwood win. In her career, she has only ever finished behind Goodnight Olive in the Breeders' Cup last year. Secret Oath, Nest, and Desert Dawn are the only other three fillies. So 4 fillies in her career have finished ahead of her.
Yeah, she's just an elite talent. Very, very lucky to have her in the barn.
Back-to-back with 112s, how'd she come out of it?
She came out of it really good. So we'll just decide what to do next. Whether she has another start or trains up to the Breeders' Cup. Steve got on a plane to go to the Dallas sale, so...
because, you know, because let's go buy some Texas breads.
Why not? Mr. Hallett grows there, so why not? We'll sit down with Winchell and map out what's next.
Do some of the horses stick up here after the meet?
Well, yeah, we'll be up here. We're usually up here most
of the time. That's your favorite part of the meet. It's great. Everybody leaves and you hang around for 3 weeks.
Yeah, that's great.
Training Gunrunner and those kinds of horses.
Yeah, we usually stay up here for 2 or 3 weeks after the meet's over.
Yeah. So. And you've stayed here with some of the best horses in the barn.
Oh, yeah. Curlin, Gunrunner, all of them spent there.
Unbelievable.
All of them spent there. We spent most of September up here with all of them.
I hate to bring this up, actually, before we talk about some other successes. And you might not be at liberty to discuss this, but how many horses are going to stay in New York long term? Because there's been some conversation about kind of paring back a little bit in New York.
Well, I think with the construction going on at Belmont, I think with them not racing there,
It
just wasn't conducive for us to, you know, keep that barn open. What's the difference between shipping from here or shipping from Belmont? I mean, you're still having to ship. So I think what we'll do is run the horses that we have from here to Belmont at the Aqueduct meet, and then reevaluate in the spring and see what we want to do.
Very good. Very good. Let's shift from Echo Zulu's fabulous performance. Again, a 1/12 buyer, and so now through this portion of the year, 3 for 3, the 97 in the winning colors, and then 2 1/12 buyers back-to-back at Saratoga. That takes us to Gunite, and when it came to the confrontation with Elite Power, it did seem, Scott, on paper and handicapping this race, that Gunite figured to be a little tougher to reel in today than he was last month.
Yeah, I mean, we definitely benefited from a softer pace scenario. There's no doubt about that. You know, Elite Power is a very special horse, and he's a champion, and he's got the best of us. But the 23-46 allowed us to be able to sprint home pretty well. And, you know, Gunite's one of those horses that really likes Saratoga as well. He won the Hopeful here.
Yeah.
He's been
second in the Jerkins.
Yes, very, very successful at this track. And, you know, put him over the $2 million mark. I just love this horse. I think he's one of the most underrated horses in the country. He, you know, he's shipped to Dubai, he's shipped to Saudi, shows up every single time. And he's just an awesome horse.
Nice to get the grade one as an older horse.
For sure, for sure. That's a big deal for us and Mr. Winchell.
Well, it's because it's important. It's important that, Ron Winchell, you know, get a, it'd be nice to have a stallion maybe to stay at somewhere.
Oh, yeah.
As if Tappet and Gunite and Tappeture and Epicenter aren't enough.
Yeah,
look at you.
Can't have too many.
That's a matter of, maybe not. The interesting thing now for him, though, now let's talk 6 furlongs versus 7 with Gunite.
Yeah, I mean, he's just very effective at both. I think he's just as good at 7 as he is 3/4.
Well, and I'm looking at the, because he ran in the mile last year, mm-hmm. in the dirt mile.
Yes. But...
We'll
see what's next. Phoenix might be an option for him at Keeneland, or we might just train him up to the Breeders' Cup. Yeah,
you're going with a loaded wagon. Scott Blasi with us to talk about the tremendous Saturday for the team, and let's go back to the Travers and run the whole thing again, guys. And we'll let Scott take us around. Joel Rosario, of course, on board, and gets a little, not that he wasn't going to kind of fall back, but take us around here, Scott, because there was a lot of interesting rides going on yesterday.
Yeah, Arcangelo definitely got a really good spot going into the first turn there. We wanted to be on the rail. We thought that was his best chance to win, was to save ground. And you know, I know Joel and Steve talked about it before the race. I thought he was much handier with the blinkers on. I do think that's one thing that Joel and Steve discussed after his last race, and I think it, you know, made him a little more, you know, generous as far as not having to ride him as hard early on in the race. As you can see here, he's just traveling and carrying Joel very well, and I think that's the difference that the blinkers made on him. You know, I was a little worried going into the turn, and then I was surprised at how fast he got to that hole on the rail. He really did quicken if you watch when it opens up. But, you know, hats off to the winner, and congratulations to them. They had a great trip, and, you know, got the jump on us a little bit right here. But, you know, Joel rode a great race, and... we think our horse is going to continue to improve.
You're watching here as Arcangelo in the pink is going to basically circle, and boom, here's the opportunity.
Yeah, he got there, got a little tight on us right here
right
at the 3/16. Had to steady just a little bit. You know, the horse was very courageous getting through that small of a hole.
It's unbelievable, watching it again.
And, switches him to the outside here,
right,
but
there, off the rail.
You know, definitely still getting to him, and
that's
great race.
Yeah, Arcangelo got the jump. Otherwise, he was right there.
Yeah, I mean, it's just part of it. We had to wait a little bit, and then it got a little tight on us at the 3/16. But very, very good race.
He's an offspring of Gunrunner. Gunite an offspring of Gunrunner. We alluded to it a few minutes ago, both going out for Winchell. Talk a little bit about the Gunrunner offspring and what they bring to the table. And do they show up at the barn? You automatically know, yeah, we got something nice here.
Well, you hope you do. I mean, you know, they seem to get better as they get older. You know, Gunrunner was such a sound horse to race and to train. And I think that not only was he an elite talent, he also you know, passes that on to his offspring. And, you know, we're very lucky to have the access to him and Ron Winchell and how they handled and developed and raced the horse. And it was nice to see him, you know, go get his full potential.
Yeah.
Have you been surprised at the precociousness of the Gun Runners, given that he was a little more of a slow burn?
Well, yeah. You know, I think it's, you know, risk it. He seems to be very precocious.
Well, we're gonna see that race.
Right. I think it just depends on what kind of mare and what they look like. You know, we were lucky to have, you know, Echo Zulu out of his first crop, Gunite out of his first crop. You know, those horses were, they were very precocious, but they were out of, you know, fast.
The Tappan mares, right, too. You got right. That's one of the strangest things about this rise, and you know what Ron Winchell and DJ Fisk, you know, have at their disposal,
yeah,
is this bizarre spark of the, not bizarre, but this incredible spark of the Gun Runner line over Tappan mares. And I mean, Ron's got how many Tappan mares are at Gainesway?
And he's a candy ride that I mean, he just basically crosses with everything. Yeah. So it's
unbelievable.
It's a luxury. You know, he's doing things that I don't know if any stallion's ever done this early in their career. But I'm no breeding expert.
Well, but you handle enough of them. I mean, and the thing that was amazing about Gunrunner coming along was it basically emerged as Tappet is basically on the back end of his career. So yeah, it's perfect timing.
Yeah, it was. It's
amazing.
It's been amazing to be able to handle so many of those horses. So,
same question here now for Disarm. It feels. I mean, he's. I'm going to guess he is now the only horse in the crop now has posted four straight triple-digit fires.
Yeah, he's definitely getting faster, and like I said, we'll see how he comes out of his race and decide what we think's best for him next.
The I'm just wondering about what's the. I'm trying to think. What's the Churchill? Is there a Churchill September meet?
Is it
the Lucas?
Yeah, it's the Lucas.
The Lucas is the
and the PA Derby, or you know, but we have options.
You can go out west too. You've done that before about going out early to Santa.
Well, we usually do go out early.
Right?
Yeah, it's I don't know. I just think for the horses to settle in, get a few works over the racetrack, I think it's definitely helped us be successful out there in the Breeders' Cup.
Just looking, I wanted to see about a sibling. If there was a 2-year-old sibling to Disarm, there is not. There is, however, a full brother yearling colt.
Yeah, hopefully
looks, coming up.
Hopefully, looks like him.
And then, I forgot that you guys have Silver State. Silver State is standing too.
Yes.
And there's a Silver State weanling. Mm-hmm.
So that's fun. Mr. Winchell's had some very nice horses.
Unbelievable. You mentioned Risk It. Do we have the Risk It race from 2 weeks ago?
I'll be told they don't have that queued up.
Oh.
He's just, you know, he's been very forward in the mornings, and he's such an athlete, and hopefully the horse will stretch out, and there'll be some big things to come out of him.
Hopeful too soon?
No, I don't think we'll run back in the hopeful. I think possibly the Iroquois.
Bring him back?
Yeah.
All right, so.
Running back at a mile.
Gotta ask, too, not every starter had a blanket put over their shoulders. Clairière on Friday.
Yeah, I don't think she handled the racetrack at all. I don't necessarily think she loves Saratoga. It was a little bit like a race last year. I think it's just, you just throw it out, you know what she's capable of, and she runs so well fresh, so we'll probably just train her straight up to the distaff like we did last year.
Nice. I'm seeing, we got a wrap, but I'm seeing questions coming in from around the country, and John in Louisville wants to know how badly you're missing your sidekick, Alex Holt.
Al and I have a lot of fun. He's actually coming up here next week.
Yeah, to close out the week?
Yeah.
Outstanding. And let's just look ahead to the next few days. I see a bunch of Ellis. We got Bankett today, right?
He's main track only.
Is FTO? Okay.
Yeah, I don't think he'll, he'll get to play today.
The rest are all maiden specials, and I don't see anything else.
I have nothing in today.
Well, you do have. How did he do that in the Louisiana down in Super Derby?
Oh yeah, we'll be watching that.
I love it. Steve comes on the show now on the radio, and it's become a whole thing, a shtick. The Steve Asmussen lock of the week. You know he's 10 for 11.
Is he really
10 for 11?
It's pretty strong.
Riskit was last week, essentially. Yeah, last time he was on, he gave out Riskit.
Pretty strong. Tune in more often.
Yeah,
you should.
We got yeah.
Curly, let's go. All right, this was great. Congratulations.
Appreciate it, guys. Thank you. Great day.
Congratulations.
All right, guys. Thanks a lot.
All right, we'll wrap it up for this edition of Loose on the Lead. Seth Merrill, Steve Bick. Enjoy the racing this afternoon. Don't forget, down at the clubhouse, we have a double promotion here at the track, Low Rollers. So a lot of fun to be had today. New York Showcase Day here at the racetrack. So keep it in mind. Play along. Cash some tickets. We'll be back in for the morning programming Wednesday morning at 9 a.m. So we'll see you then.
You're watching OTB TV, a service of Capital Off-Track Betting.